Hey everyone, welcome to Talk Nerdy. I'm your host, Kara Santa Maria. This week, I want to specifically thank Brian Holden, Jeffrey Sewell, Chuck Pell, let's see, Richard Audie, might be Aud, A-U-D-E, I think it's Audie, and lastly, Thong Cha, for supporting the podcast. If you want to help support the show and keep it 100% free to download, and also, you know, help me out a little to improve these microphones and maybe eventually the laptop, because, man, it's getting old. All you have to do is go to carasantamaria.com and click through to the Patreon link. You can also go there directly by hitting up patreon.com/talknerdy. All right, guys, I am excited to welcome this week to the show the energy and environment reporter for the Austin American Statesman and author of the brand new book, Year of the Dunk, A Modest Defiance of Gravity. Here he is, Asher Price. So Asher, thank you so much for joining me in my humble home studio.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Of course, I'm excited. So you are here actually right now in LA, promoting your book, right?
Exactly. Giving a reading and also seeing friends and
cool.
Some family.
And so this is the tail end of your trip. You're actually going straight to the airport from here.
That's right. From here, I shoot on down Highland to La Brea to La Cienega. Boom.
So right. Yep. That's the best way to go. Avoid the 405 at all costs. So what have you done so far? You said you've hung out with some friends. You've done some actual readings, like at bookstores.
Yeah, I did a reading at the Barnes & Noble in Santa Monica, and I saw my aunt who lives down near Long Beach, and some friends of mine from high school and college are out on the West Coast now, and so I saw them too.
Yeah. So just to back up a little bit so that people who are listening know, you currently live in Austin, right?
That's right, yeah.
And you're a reporter, an energy and environment reporter at the Austin American Statesman.
Exactly.
But are you from Texas? See, I want to know this because I'm a good old Texan girl.
Yeah, sure. Well, it's nice to meet a good old Texan girl here in L.A. Yeah, so here's the short version of the long, sordid history. I was born in L.A., and my parents had lived in L.A. in the 60s and 70s. My dad had been a law professor at UCLA, and in the early 80s, they moved on over to New York City with me. I was 3 or 4 years old and my two older brothers. Mm-hmm. And I grew up in New York City on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, and went to a prep school in New York, and then speaking of Texas women, mm-hmm. I met my girlfriend, now my wife, freshman year of college, and she was from Austin, born and raised in Austin, and after school and after grad school, she wanted to move back to Texas, and her parents still live in Austin. And I was able to get a job at the Austin American Statesman. That was a little over 10 years ago now, and it's the only full-time job I've ever really had, and I really like the newspaper and my colleagues and editors, so I love Austin, so I'm really happy there.
Oh, great. So you enjoy being a staff reporter?
Oh, yeah. I really do. I mean, the newspaper has put a lot of emphasis on doing investigative work.
Nice.
And there's a lot of investigative work to be done in Texas, especially
sure.
on a kind of intersection of environment and politics. And so my day job is spending time doing a lot of that kind of work.
So you went to a university in
Yale.
New York. Oh, you went to Yale. Okay, great.
We went
great.
To Yale. That's where we met.
And then you also went to grad school in New York?
No. My wife, Rebecca, she was my girlfriend at the time.
Mm-hmm.
She went to Oxford to study English Lit.
Cool.
And I tagged along. I got into a master's program in something called comparative social policy. And so I did a master's degree in that in Oxford. But that's sort of about, you know, like comparing different welfare states, the welfare system in Scandinavia versus the US, or homeless policies and or policing policies, that sort of thing. Gotcha. But anyway, so I spent time in Oxford, and then I, you know, did a couple other odd things, but then pretty quickly made my way down to Austin.
Nice. Did you study? So for your master's, you had this kind of interesting program. What fed into that? Did you study journalism? Was it poli sci?
I was an English major in college.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I wasn't one of these kids who, you know, knew he wanted to be an academic or something. In fact, I knew I didn't want to be. I liked, you know, reading good books.
Nice.
And the faculty was really good. So that's how I ended up being an English major. And then there was a college daily newspaper, and I worked a little bit on the college daily. I wrote some stories for it, but I was never like a full-throated, you know, staff or editor for the College Daily.
Mm-hmm.
I did kind of summer, you know, newspaper jobs, newspaper reporting jobs. One of my first jobs was working for a newspaper called The Forward in New York City, which was an old-school Yiddish paper that, you know, now had an English edition. And so my job that summer was doing things like writing obituaries of old lefty union organizers.
That's awesome. So you really kind of went through the ranks. It's interesting because I feel like journalism, and in some ways too, the field that I'm sort of in a weird intersection of journalism and production, kind of television work. These are two worlds where you don't have to have academically studied what you do to be very good at what you do. I know a lot of journalists, and I know a lot of producers and directors who are by the book academics, and I know a whole lot of them who studied either something in a totally different field or never even went to college and just learned the ropes in the field.
Yeah, I think for the kind of work we're doing, mm-hmm. one of the really important things is to be able to communicate.
Sure.
You know, you want to get things right, but you also want to be able to communicate them clearly. And so, on the getting things right part, you know, it's important to figure out who to talk to and what to talk to them about, and write down or broadcast what they're saying accurately.
Yeah.
But it's its own kind of skill to be able to communicate those things clearly as well, and to be able to, you know, write or talk about them in a way that, for my purposes, a general audience can understand.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I think that's really important. And it's an interesting arena because we're going to get to the book in a second. I'm really intrigued by this book because it's sort of one part memoir, one part SciComm, which is interesting to me. So you work as a full-time staff reporter, pure, clean journalism. You do investigative work, but you focus specifically on energy and environment, which is, as we know, and you mentioned earlier, especially important in a place like Texas, yeah. in a rich oil, you know, place where they actually do a lot of great clean and green energy, but they also are really, really entrenched in kind of traditional fossil fuel industry also.
Sure.
So that's an interesting area in and of itself. The book that you wrote, however, and I'll just give it a plug right here off the top, A Year of the Dunk, A Modest Defiance of Gravity. And we'll talk all about what it's about because that's really intriguing. Has a little bit of science communication thrown in. And lately, I've been really intrigued having these conversations. I just said intrigued like three times. Having these conversations with either traditional journalists or people that we consider to be more science communicators about the differences, about how they support each other, but about how there kind of might need to be a distinction between the two. And I'm interested to hear your take on this. I worked at HuffPost as the science reporter back when science was atrocious there. I helped them build a science page. I mean, science is still atrocious there. But at least now there's a page that's kind of a place for science.
Uh-huh.
So it's not just on the health pages with like the Deepak Chopra and all the woo and all the bullshit. We tried to build a real science page that had a legitimate home for science. Successful or not, I mean, I'm not there anymore and it's hard for me to, but at the time I was trying to affect change from inside the system. And so, but I'm a science communicator first and foremost. I kind of tried out the journalism. I sometimes work as a journalist. I do a local show here as a journalist, like more legitimately, but it's hard to go back and forth because with SciComm, oftentimes what I find is that a big part of what you're doing is advocacy. You're trying to advocate for the scientific process and for more science in sort of the public. And sometimes when you do advocacy work as a writer, as an on-air personality, whatever, the whole journalistic side of things kind of goes out the window.
I think you're getting at a lot of really interesting things. Mm-hmm. And these are things that, you know, I grapple with in my work as a reporter. I think one way of thinking about, you know, so a conventional American way of thinking about journalism is kind of he said, she said stories. Mm. And that you have to give, you know, both sides equal weight. Mm-hmm. But I think you run into a problem if, you know, one person is saying the sky outside is blue and the other person says it's raining and then the sky outside is actually blue. So how is a reporter, as a communicator, as a journalist, mm-hmm. do you signal to the reader that, well, actually the sky outside is blue and the person who's saying the sky is blue is right? I mean, mm-hmm. there's objective truths in the world. You know, in my work, I'm willing to say when it's appropriate, and my editors are fine with it. You know, this person says the sky is blue. This person says the sky is rainy. The National Weather Service reports that the sky was blue.
Yeah, that's a good.
You know, readers can. But it's important that the reporter goes to that is willing to point that out. Mm-hmm. This came up recently in Texas. About the relationship between things related to fracking operations and earthquakes in Texas, and to what degree, is there a relationship? And you know, you had policymakers, even as scientists in other states, including Oklahoma, were recognizing some relationship. You had important policymakers in Texas who were unwilling to acknowledge that there might be a relationship. Mm-hmm. And so it's my job as a reporter to say, well, this person says that there isn't a relationship, but these studies that are peer-reviewed and so forth say there is.
Yeah. And then it gets complicated, I find, when we're talking about topics that there's less science to support the opinion, but the opinion itself is fundamental to the scientific process. So one of the things that I've run up against, or that I historically ran up against when I was working in a more traditional journalistic capacity, was animal studies. So any scientist, if you ask them if animal research is necessary, they'll say 100%. It's the only way we know what we know, and it's something that we even have to politically be careful about with our lab. Like most research facilities won't let reporters in to see the animals. They definitely don't publish pictures of the animals, and it's mostly because there are activists on the other side who they're afraid will potentially do something that could be damaging to the research. So intrinsic in the studies is this is how they figured out that this vaccine works, or this is how they figured out that, you know, this is what's happening in a human brain because they were able to do these studies on a primate brain or whatever. The problem comes in when you're trying to communicate science or when you're trying to do reporting and you want to talk about something like that, you trip over yourself when you're questioning, can I say that this is right? Can I say that this is necessary? Or do I have to say, well, the scientific community says X, activists say X, you decide.
Uh-huh.
And that's so frustrating for me. It's the same thing with like GMOs. It's the same thing with climate change. And sometimes it's more clear cut than other times, which is why I always liked science communication better than traditional puristic journalism. I think because for me, it unleashes me to be able to put a little bit of personal perspective in it, which you really can't do when you are trying to stick to, you know, by the book journalism.
I think that's right. I mean, I think that I'm trying to think about whether my colleagues who write about higher education, mm-hmm. higher education policy, or transportation, if they're at a disadvantage in this regard. I think that in general there's this problem of, you know, that facts are often inconvenient, and so how do you fold them into a story, and how do you go that extra mile to pointing out that there exist these facts in mm-hmm. the world? I think my colleagues at the Statesman do a great job along those lines. So I'm not sure whether I have more or less freedom in my job than they
interesting.
Do.
Interesting. Yeah. And you know, this is not why, but this is an interesting aspect to traditional reporting. I've met, you know, quite a few journalists who do traditional, they're on staff, they're not freelance, so they only work for one outlet, and they do what we think of as traditional reporting as their day job, but then they might write a book on the side. And when you go to write that book, like all bets are off. You know, you'll use all of the skills that you've acquired, and you'll obviously want to maintain journalistic integrity as you write the book, but you can kind of do whatever you want in a book.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot more freedom. Mm-hmm. There's a lot more freedom as a writer. Stylistically, I mean, mm-hmm. I don't write about myself in the pages of the Austin American Statesman. I write, I'm a main character of this book, Year of the Dunk. But I also, I can stretch my legs out a little bit also with the reporting I'm doing, with the people I'm talking to, but also my willingness or opportunity to report on things that just don't come up in my daily beat.
Gotcha. Yeah. So you get to write about something that you never would have kind of had the, I guess, allowance from the editors to be able to write about, because that's somebody else's beat.
Yeah. I mean, nobody really has the dunking beat at the newspaper.
But sports, even just doing kind of the science of sports.
Yeah.
Is
there's
very
no
interesting.
Right. And there's no science of sports beat mm-hmm. at the paper. So
most papers don't even have a science beat anymore.
Right. I mean, we actually don't technically have a science beat.
Yeah, lots of times they're kind of, there might be an energy and environment, so there's science within that. There might be a health beat.
Right, there is that, yeah.
Yeah, or kind of a weather, sometimes that fits in something bigger like environment.
Yeah.
But there are certain pure science stories, like when there's a great physics story or something that are kind of divvied up. Like, do you cover those?
Occasionally. I mean, there was just, you know, obviously Austin's home to a great research university, mm-hmm. University of Texas. And, you know, some UT researchers, astronomers, were just involved in the detection of Kepler 452b, this, you know, Goldilocks planet that's, I think, 1,400 light years away, mm-hmm. Which is really far.
it
takes
really
8 minutes
far.
For light to come from the sun to our planet, right? So
yeah.
1,400 light years, that's really far away.
It's really far.
It's mind bogglingly far.
And it's one of those stories that I think the media loves to report as being a little more salacious than it is. It's a fucking phenomenal finding. Don't get me wrong. It's a phenomenal finding. But as more and more information rolls in, I think more and more researchers, and I'm actually hoping to have one on the show within the next couple of weeks, are saying, like, man, it's not really like Earth. Like, we want to say it's just
well,
like
we don't.
Earth.
It's hard. Right. Well, who knows? I mean, yes. Right.
Yeah.
It's hard to tell, I think.
But it does have some of those parameters that we're looking for as these kind of life candidate planets.
Right, right. But anyway, it doesn't naturally, you know, we get a press release about that. It doesn't naturally fall. It's not an environmental story.
True.
It's
yeah.
not a health story. I mean, I ended up writing about it happily. I you know, fondly remember 10th grade high school astronomy, but that's exactly the kind of thing you're talking about. I mean, we don't have a science reporter per se, so it gets divvied up.
Were you assigned to that, or did you kind of volunteer and say, this is a fun story?
I was assigned to that.
You were just assigned to it.
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay,
yeah.
Cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
I like that, too, about traditional journalism, because I think that takes some of the personal emotion out of the stories. Like, again, it's something I'm bad at because I'm like, ooh, I want to write about this. This matters to me. Well, but
I mean, being assigned I'd say the majority of my stories, I tell my editor we ought to write about this or that. And that's
you do pitch.
Yeah, I pitch exactly. I mean, in the paper wants it to be that way because the expertise on various issues has been delegated around the paper.
Sure, you don't want somebody who's like, you know, a food reporter writing about physics discoveries.
Exactly. My editor also doesn't want to be, he trusts his, you know, his group of five or six reporters, his beat reporters to determine these things. So, you know, I have conversation with him about whether such a thing ought to be in the newspaper. Is it a Metro story? Is it a, you know, is it an A1 story? These sorts of things.
But I definitely think there is an importance to the traditional system of saying, you know what, you're writing this. You know, once in a blue moon, there's going to be a story, and it's like, who wants it? And everybody's like, I don't know. And it's like, well, you're getting it. So you got to do your research, and you got to report on it cleanly, and you got to learn shit, because maybe you didn't already know the outcome.
The Statesman, you know, pays my bills. So, yep. And I whatever they, meaning the editorial staff, would like me to write about, I mean, I'm grateful for having a newspaper job.
And have they been supportive in the in the process of writing and publishing a book and going and promoting it?
Extremely.
That's
I mean,
awesome.
they were kind enough, first of all, to give me leave for 7 months to write the book. And you know, my hat's off to my colleagues who had to take up the slack when I was gone at the newspaper. Yeah, and I even did some of the working out of the book involved with the book. I mean, the book's about my efforts at age 34, 35 to try to dunk a basketball for the first time. So it involved a lot of working out and jumping and stuff. And some of that was done in the gym at the Statesman, which is called the press room.
That's adorable.
Yeah.
I love that. That's really cool to see those things come together. So, and I also think that that's obviously a perfect segue to really talk about what this book is about and how you were able to flex some of those new muscles, I think. But this is not your first book, right?
No, I wrote a book with another journalist, Kate Galbraith, who's actually now a reporter up in the Bay Area and also writes about stuff in Sacramento. Mm-hmm. She was a reporter in Texas, and she and I teamed up to write a book about pioneers in and the politics involved with wind power in Texas.
Interesting. Did you find that after writing that book, I mean, did you do a lot of press around that? Did you have to pull that kind of pundit role and go on some news shows and give them your spiel?
You know, I think partly it was through an academic press. And I mean, it's an interesting story about how how wind power moved from kind of being a kind of hippie-ish alternative thing to big business in Texas, and some of the ironies that are involved with an oil and gas state and a kind of free market-minded state doing a renewable wind energy push.
And you covered some big political players in
the
book.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, George W. Bush is a player in it, Ann Richards, Ken Lay is a character in the book, you know, because he was trying to, you know, get Enron in on some of the Windrush. I think we were kind of, this is a completely different experience. That was a sort of more, let's say, a quieter book in the sense that we didn't press all that. We got a great review by the AP, actually, but we didn't sort of sell ourselves around to try to promote it outside of Texas, the regional book. And now, you know, this is a thrilling experience for me, you know, with a big trade publishing house, Crown, and going around to different bits of the country to talk about the book. And
so it's cool because it seems like it's more more straight promotion. Like you get to go, you get to read excerpts, you get to do book signings and things like that. You're not having to go on Fox News because it's not a political book. you're not having to go on Fox News and give a spiel, and oh my God, that's the worst. It's the worst. Like being yes, a force
but that, that having been said, if Fox News wants to have me on, I'm happy to talk about the book wherever.
True. Okay. Any Fox News producers who are listening, Asher would love to promote the book, but at least you don't have to get all pundity. It's I'm telling you, it's the worst. Yeah. It's like
I'll
not
take a word
fun
for
at
it.
All. And so, yes, let's talk about this book. It is obviously not a political book, but it's a book that is very personal to you. Okay. So you mentioned before, this is about your kind of effort of trying to dunk a basketball. Lifelong dream, I'm assuming, since you were a kid.
Well, I think a lot of people fantasize about dunking a basketball, and very few of us ever actually do it or even try to do it.
Well, in like a regulation size goal.
Yeah,
I think
right.
Lots of little kids dunk basketballs in like
true.
A tiny backyard.
That's right. That's right. And but that kind of gulf between what we daydream about and what we're really capable of, whether mm-hmm. it's dunking a basketball or, you know, you might wonder about yourself whether you would have been a, I don't know, a rocket scientist mm-hmm. or a painter or whatever, you know, we all have these daydreams. And for me, the fantasy was about whether I could dunk a basketball. And it was a fantasy, you know, I trace back to 1986, which was the slam dunk, that year, the slam dunk competition. The finalists were Dominique Wilkins, the 6'8", amazing dunker from the Atlanta Hawks, known as the human highlight film, mm-hmm. and his rookie teammate Spud Webb, who was 5'6".
No,
yeah, and he was making the league minimum for because he was a rookie, which was $70,000.
Yeah,
and this 1986 slam dunk competition was in Dallas. That was where All Star Weekend was that year, and Spud Webb was from Dallas. And in fact, 3 or 4 of his brothers and sisters and his parents wanted to come to the dunk competition. And Spud Webb knew one of the scalpers and bought tickets for them to come sit in the stands at Reunion Arena and to watch the dunk competition. And it's one of my earliest memories. I was 7 years old, 6 or 7 years old, 1986. And and there was Spud Webb, who really wasn't that much taller than I was
at the time. How funny.
Throwing down these amazing dunks where he would, you know, his hands were too small to palm the ball, so he had to, you know, bounce it high off the floor and catch it in midair and throw it down or throw it off the backboard. And so that kind of I remember that capturing my imagination, the way that when you're 6 or 7, certain things kind of burn in your memory.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, Billy Idol and the White Wedding music video, which my older brothers watched all the time on MTV, like, that was something I remember from that period, too. And so, growing up, I was never much of an athlete. I never made any effort to get in, you know, super shape and see how high I could jump.
So, and you did you play in any sports teams?
I played Ultimate Frisbee.
Sure.
which, you know, has its own athleticism, but it's there was no weightlifting involved. There was no kind of
pushing myself.
But
when did you play
that?
That's like a college game, isn't it?
So I played that a bit in high school and then in college.
High school, college. Okay.
And
cool.
I even played after college a little bit too.
See, I always thought that Ultimate Frisbee like required that you test positive for cannabis. Like, that's like a rule to be able to play Ultimate Frisbee.
I'm not. I wonder how cannabis would affect jumping ability. Actually,
probably not. It's definitely, I think, a performance not enhancing. What's the opposite of enhancing?
Diminishing.
Yeah, yeah. It's a performance diminishing drug.
Yeah.
Okay. So you're 6 or 7. You're the spark is there.
Yeah.
But
right.
Obviously, it doesn't push you too much because right. all through your childhood, you're like, mad.
Yeah. I was one of those guys. I grew up in Manhattan, and you know, all these buildings have awnings coming out, you know, with doormen. Mm-hmm. And I remember going around the streets of Manhattan in sort of happy-go-lucky, trying to hit awnings, you know, jump and hit awnings. But I never really tried to reach the upper ones.
And and you're not short.
I no, mean, I'm not short. Yeah.
They can't see you. The that's people right. who are listening right. right now.
That's
you're
right.
You're over 6 feet, right?
I'm 8 feet tall.
No, well, I'm why is this so difficult for you,
Asher? I'm 6'2 and a half.
Okay, so you're a tall guy, but you're still not anywhere close to what we think of as traditional NBA players.
Right, exactly. I call myself vaguely tall.
You're pretty mm-hmm. tall.
I'm pretty
I would
tall.
Say you're pretty tall, but you're not freakishly tall.
Yes, that's right. I'm not freakishly tall.
Yeah, you are almost a full foot taller. I'm 5'3", so you are 11 and a half inches taller than me.
I was getting into my mid-30s, and I was wondering, like I think a lot of people wonder, about what kind of talent they've left on the table. Mm. You know, what abilities do we have lurking in our bones that we've never really, you know, taken out for a spin?
Yeah, like I really, really want to learn how to play guitar. And I'm 31. I'll be 32 this year. And yeah. I'm like, am I too old? Will
right.
I be able to, will it just be too hard to be worth
exactly.
it?
These are the kinds of questions. And it could turn out that you're a guitar genius.
Could turn out that I totally suck.
That's totally possible. So, but, you know, there's a whole physical element. Unlike playing guitar, I mean, my flexibility, not that I ever was so flexible, is declining. There are various things. My body is breaking down in various ways. And so it felt like the window for trying to dunk a basketball, to seeing if I had this talent, was closing.
Sure. Yeah. You want to maximize your joints, your muscles, all of those things. And that's not going to, as we know.
Right. It's not going to become easier.
Yeah. We're not on an upswing, right?
Yeah. Right. Exactly.
So the interesting thing is that during this kind of journey, this chronicle of your journey, you do cover a lot of history and you cover actually quite a bit of science, which this is, I think, really why I was so excited to have you on the podcast. You were introduced to me by he's actually quite young, but by a previous producer on a show that I worked on for quite some time. And I guess you said that you know him through his brother. And when he first told me, okay, I have this friend and he wrote this book and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, what does that have to do with what I do? And then I realized, you know what? There's this whole area of science and sports that I never touch on my podcast. My podcast is a science podcast. You are the first person, and we are on episode, what episode are we
70.
On? Like 68 or something crazy like that. Let me look, actually, so I'm not misquoting. We are going to be the episode that you air. Oh my God, SoundCloud, would you load already? Mm-hmm. We're on episode 73. You'll be number 73. And I've never once even...
I'm the inaugural sports science person.
I've never once even tackled sports. It's crazy to me. Yeah. So I'm really excited to do it in this way because it's sort of snuck in underneath some other cool stuff. Uh-huh. I'm just not. Are you a sports guy?
I mean, I like watching sports.
You do?
Yeah. Like, I mean, really... there are certain, my wife and I should say, like watching sports together. I mean, we love watching football, soccer, basketball.
Is in that order?
It depends.
You live in Texas.
It depends on the season, I'd say.
Okay, gotcha. You like whatever's on.
Me in during the fall, my wife Rebecca is, you know, on Saturdays she's got her UT Longhorns jersey on, and on Sundays she's got her Dallas Cowboys jersey on.
Sure, it's very. You guys are so Texas.
And she's a character in the book. Actually, she grew up a huge Michael Jordan fan.
Nice.
And she has a brother who is a dunker. And so
how tall is he?
He's 6'7".
Gotcha. So he's got a little edge on you.
He's got a little edge. Every inch counts.
Are you guys Mavs fans?
No.
Interesting.
I mean, I grew up a Knicks fan and now we're Spurs fans.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Yeah, I forgot. You're South. So my family is crazy about the Mavericks. They're like, you know, season tickets going all the time. Because we grew up in Dallas.
Uh-huh.
And they have a Nash jersey from back the first time
right.
he was on, like signed in the room with the pool table. It's pretty crazy.
So, well, you'll appreciate this. Her brother Ben played pro ball, second division pro ball in Germany for a year, and went up against Dirk Nowitzki when Dirk was 17 years old.
Hilarious.
And
did Dirk just crush him?
Well, Ben tells a story about shooting a three over Dirk, getting it.
That's awesome. You know?
And then he tells a story about how later in the game, Dirk was going one-on-one basically against him on a fast break, I think, and just dunked it in Ben's face. And Ben writes about how Ben has talked about how fast it all happened. Like, the one thing he was struck by was the speed of the game at that level.
I could definitely see that. I mean, that's the one thing. I am not a sports person at all. My go-to response back on the show, actually, Take Part Live, that I worked on with Alex, the producer who put us in touch, my go-to response anytime anybody mentioned sports on air was, what is sport? Like, I'm just so out of
the loop. Weren't into the Mavs yourself.
I wasn't so much. And this is also my father and his family. So I was like already out of the house and didn't really spend much time with them. But I grew up, when I was in high school, I was a cheerleader. You know, I was like the captain of the cheerleader. It was like crazy. It's totally anti-type for me. And so I was forced to go to every football game and this is Plano, Texas. It's a suburb of Dallas. It's a big town. People know 5A schools, very competitive, good sports teams. And watch Friday Night Lights. That was my life, and I hated it. I was so anti. I love cheerleading because I love doing the real cheerleading competitions.
Uh-huh, like, and the tumbling and all that stuff.
Yes, all that. The tumbling, the stunting. Yeah, and I loved the sport for the sport itself. It's just another aspect of the sport is that you have to like shake your pom-poms, which I hated. Anyway, that being said, I will say that as much as I'm like, what is sport? And really, really do not enjoy football. Baseball growing up was a pastime for me. A cousin of mine played Major League Baseball, which was really exciting for the whole family. His little brother was starting at UT.
Wow.
They're just, as a freshman, like they were a very cool baseball family. So I enjoyed the atmosphere of a live baseball game, being there in person with the hot dogs and the hanging out and the playing behind the bleachers. And I also will say, even to this day, I'll watch a basketball playoff game and I'll really enjoy it. This is getting back to what you're saying, because it's so fast. I find basketball really intriguing because it keeps my attention. Some sports like soccer, I can't handle soccer. I can't handle golf. They're too freaking slow. Hockey, low scoring sports are very hard for me. But basketball, it's like, now he's got it. Now he's got it. What's going on now? It just keeps your attention, for me at least, a little bit more.
And they dunk.
And they dunk, I mean, right?
I think one of the things that, you know, the project started off for me as a lark, like, okay, I'm 34. Can I dunk a basketball? I met with a friend at a court and, had these pathetic early attempts. And and then the more I thought about the dunk and basketball, the more I thought there might be something to write about, both because the dunk is a very American thing. Basketball is very American. It's uniquely American. It's originally American.
It has spread, though, right?
It has spread, yeah. Of course. It's a global sport now, thanks to the great dunker Michael Jordan.
And it's in the Olympics now.
It's in the Olympics. Yeah. But the dunk, the dunk works as a metaphor for things about upward mobility, and you have, it's a way of getting it, in these memoirs of basketball players, the dunk is like an important rite of passage that often is a ticket out of poverty. And
that's a theme with a lot of sports, especially that we think of now, where, you look at basketball players in the 70s and 80s, they look very different than basketball players look now. It's a predominantly minority played sport. Football too, I think, at this point. And you do hear, and it's so like just empowering, you hear these stories of kids growing up in Compton, kids growing up in the inner city, and it really is kind of their only way out.
Charles Barkley, in his autobiography Outrageous, he tells a story about growing up in Leeds, Alabama, and how they had a 3-foot-tall chain link fence around his house, and he would just jump back and forth for a couple hours at a time to build up his leg muscles because he wanted to dunk so badly. And he writes quite explicitly about how the first time he dunked, it was the first time he thought, maybe I can get out of Leeds.
But there
was all kinds of other things to write about the physics of the dunk, about biomechanics, and about why humans actually are quite lousy jumpers.
Oh, yeah, compared to other animals?
Compared to other animals. You know, evolutionarily, why that's the case.
And why is that the case? Why can't we really jump?
Well, I guess one way of thinking about it positively is that we're fantastic long-distance runners.
Oh, sure, sure. Yeah, so, I've read that quite a few times.
Right.
We're not amazing at sprinting. Like some.
No, we're actually pretty bad.
Yeah, like some people, obviously, like the Olympic sprinters are pretty okay. But in general, we're not good at running away from predators.
Let me ask you a question. Who would win a 25-meter dash? You or Killer the dog?
Oh,
Killer is
very, so people who are listening, they probably already know, but Killer is very small and he's really lazy.
Okay. All right. Well, most dogs would beat you in a 25 meter dash.
He probably would actually. When I'm hiking with him, he can run off and it scares the shit out of me because I'm like, where did he go?
Well, we were selected. So by the way, big disclaimer here. I mean, I've already talked about this, but I'm not a scientist by training. Okay.
Yeah, and I think that's why this is so fast. I was actually about to ask you, like, how frustrating or exciting or all these mixes of emotions was it for you to start writing about something and requiring that you be a science journalist with a broad beat, something that you probably haven't done before?
I thought it was terrific. I mean, for example, with this evolution of our running ability and our jumping ability. I mean, one of the great things about being a reporter is that you get to pick up a phone and talk to people. So I who you normally wouldn't speak with. So I called Dan Lieberman, who's a evolutionary biologist at Harvard, and who writes a lot about this issue. And he was kind enough to talk with me a little bit about this. I mean, I also read stuff he had written about it, but to kind of reduce things a bit. Basically, we were selected for our long distance running ability is a way to hunt down prey. This is back a long time ago, before we really even had projectiles, before we had spears. We would chase after antelope and the like,
and just wear them out,
and then like brain them or.
Jesus.
Whatever we did, strangle them. I don't know, but it was hand to hand combat, right? I mean, but
so it's less about our ability to run away from other predators. It's about our ability to be the predator.
That's my understanding.
That makes more sense.
And so that that we were selected for our ability to perspire, for things involving amount of hair on our body, but our all these things that went to long distance running ability. And when you're selected for watching the Olympics, you can't be both a great marathon runner and a great 100-meter dash runner. So you're giving up certain things in favor of others, really.
Even the way you eat is different. Marathon runners just like load up on carbs because they need before the runs, they need all of this like early energy and then late energy, and they have to like have a different diet than somebody who's a sprinter.
Right, exactly. So, but our chimp predecessors, they had hops. They were jumping from tree to tree.
Oh, for sure.
And so we gave up, or we were selected for these other sorts of things that gave us advantages as we kind of climbed down from the trees and started chasing after prey that then gave us other advantages with more protein rich diets and stuff
and
like that.
And then of course our brains grew and we were able to go like, I'm kind of lazy. I don't want to have to do this anymore. I'll just throw an object at it.
Right, right. So when I am trying to dunk a basketball, in a way I'm going against not only whatever my own personal limitations are. I mean, my vertical jump was pretty pathetic at the start of all this. But I'm also going against our sort of species-wide evolutionary direction. So that's there were a bunch of different things to get into science-wise. That was, that was something. But I also found myself getting fascinated by how other species jump. So one of the fun things to do, one of the fun things about being a reporter and working on this book was going to Cambridge, England, and meeting with an entomologist there. who studies the highest jumping insects in the world.
And are they better than, like, pound for pound, are they better than the highest jumping non-insect animal?
Well, let me put it this way. Mm-hmm. There's an insect called the frog hopper.
Okay.
And it one thing it does, it has these Velcro-like pads, and it is it's kind of getting ready to spring up. It locks its legs in place, sort of building up its potential energy. And these are tiny, you know, insects found in England, in Canada, other parts of the Commonwealth, you know, sort of northern climes. If we had the jumping ability of a frog hopper, which is a slightly ridiculous statement in itself because they're a completely different kind of animal than we are. We could jump over the St. Louis Arch.
No, that's insane.
So, like,
I love hearing stories like that about insects. We forget they even exist half the time, even though their biomass is, like, you know, so much more than everything else in the world, and they've got so much more biodiversity. But it's so crazy when you actually compare, like, our ability to an insect's ability. Like, ants can carry however much of their own body weight,
right.
And so these frog hoppers could. That's crazy.
Yeah. But you just remember, we're much smarter than they are.
We are much smarter. That's true. And we probably have much longer lives.
Yeah,
I'll give you that.
That's right. That's right.
Frog hopper
high
bug.
Five I'm, being human.
Yeah. I'm looking up the frog hopper right now. There's a Nat Geo article about it.
Yeah.
I want to see pictures.
There's a guy named Malcolm Burrows.
He's quoted right
in
this article.
Yeah, so I went to his office. There's a whole scene with him. And interestingly, he had been a postdoc in Oregon in the 1960s, and he told me he remembered watching Dick Fosbury, who was this trailblazing high jumper, do the high jump in the 60s. Dick Fosbury started the style of high jumping called the Fosbury flop, where you jump sort of backwards over the bar.
Yeah, okay. That's how everybody does it.
That's how everybody does it now. And there's a whole interesting thing there about sort of lifting your center of gravity without necessarily having your whole body over the bar at the same time.
So, yeah, because you almost do this curvature thing where you, like, undulate over
exactly.
the bar.
Exactly. And Dick Fosbury had no idea what he was doing. He was a mediocre, you know, ninth grade high jumper. And he was about to quit the high jumping team and his team in Medford, Oregon. And he went to a track meet, and he started. So everybody else was doing what was called the Western roll, where they ran up, went belly facing the bar, you know, face down over the bar, one leg and then the other,
almost like diving over it.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And he started leaning backwards, and in this one meet was able to increase his personal best by 6 inches.
Wow.
And everyone's like, what the hell is he doing?
I bet you they were all like, he's cheating. Like,
I think they were sort of astonished, and he was astonished himself. And then, you know, whatever it was, 5 or 6 years after that, I think he won the Olympics with it.
Insane.
And, you know, that goes back to the difference between us and insects, and something I kind of think about in the book is the frog hopper is not going to think creatively about how it can improve.
Yeah, it's almost, it's not thinking at all. I mean, it may be thinking, and with its, they don't even have brains, they have like nuclei of cells, but it's doing what it in some ways is kind of genetically programmed to do.
Right, right. And here's a human who's, you know, through human creativity is improving trajectory. So I found myself thinking for a while, is there like something I could be doing to dunk a basketball that other people haven't thought of?
And then you were like, wait, people have been doing this for a really
right,
long
right,
time.
Exactly. There's been a lot of human ingenuity about this, and they haven't figured out, you know, a new way to lift their bodies up to the rim.
Except maybe a trampoline.
That's right. Or a ladder.
Did you try at the beginning with a springboard or a trampoline just so that you could get the feel of what it's like to dunk a basketball and the feel of what it's like to land on your ankles?
No.
You know, after you dunk a basketball?
No, that's a great question. no, I mean, I I dunked on shorter rims to build my way up.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I had a couple different sort of gurus who were testing me and helping me along. There was a crew at a place called the Hospital for Special Surgery in New York City. Mm-hmm. They put me through all kinds of flexibility tests and sort of put together a regimen for me.
So they were like PT, like physical.
Yeah, they were like physical therapists, yeah. Exactly. And then there was also a guy named Charles Austin who runs a gym near Austin, in a town called San Marcos. And Charles Austin won the gold medal in the high jump in the 1996 Olympics.
Cool.
It's 7 feet 10 inches. He hoisted himself over the height of your door.
Yeah, that's insane to me.
So it's crazy.
Is like even more. It's funny because the dunk is like this quintessential you've been talking about. I mean, it's the goal of the entire book,
right?
And it's this kind of, I guess, analogy for American upward mobility. But that's just your hand that has to make. Mm-hmm. And how high is it though? It's really high.
That's a good question. The rim is 10 feet tall.
Yeah, that's
insane.
You
have to get your hand, as he said, over that. So Charles Austin, anyway, put me through, you know, my paces and all kinds of exercises to kind of build my ups.
Did you learn how to high jump?
I didn't learn how to high jump.
That seems scary to me. Like you could really injure yourself if you don't know what you're doing.
Well, there's actually one way of describing the Fosbury's breakthrough is that it was about that time in the early 60s that big high jump mats started coming into vogue. Before that, they would land on sawdust.
Oh, yeah.
And
so there's no way.
Yeah. So you could think of the history and science of it that way, that it was in kind of dovetailed with this. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't want to land on the back of your neck.
Yeah. That's how they land, right?
Exactly.
Kind of their shoulder blade area?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. You couldn't do that on sawdust. That would be horrifying.
Yeah.
Wow. So you're going through the motions. You're working with all these amazing trainers, physiologists, really. You're learning about both the physical limitations, the forces that, you know, calculating at what angle do you have to take off from your ankles, and also what's going on in your muscles, with your bones, with your
fast
tendons.
Twitch and slow twitch muscles.
Yes.
And to what extent can we, you know, transform our bodies that way.
And
that
how your brain actually controls those muscles, kind of the neural signals within your muscles.
Right.
How the how the muscles shorten down and all of the little scaffoldings and proteins that are involved in that. I used to know what they're all called. I should know what they're all called. So you're learning all of this. At the same time, you're really putting yourself through the ringer physically.
Yeah.
Did you ever go like, why the am I doing this?
I actually thought that quite a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think I would have done it if a publisher hadn't taken the idea seriously and was willing to pay me to write the book.
Because that does bind you in a way, because that's how I think some people don't realize, or maybe they do, but that's how book publishing works it now and kind of has for a long time, is you get an advance.
Right.
They pay you
exactly.
up front to write this book.
I'm lucky enough to have been, you know, commissioned, as it were, mm-hmm. in a way to write this book.
So you
write a book proposal, and then my agent, my great agent, David Halpern, shops the proposal around, and a publishing house is willing to, you know, take on the project. And so then once you're in that situation, you know, what I said began as a lark really seemed real. And one thing I was struck by throughout the project was how earnestly other people took it.
Sure.
I mean, I said earlier, you know, I would email and speak to Dan Lieberman or Malcolm Burrows, or I corresponded with Steve Vogel, who's a scientist down at Duke, mm-hmm. and a lot of other people. And you know, my email said. Or when I picked up the phone, I said, I'm a journalist in Texas. I'm working on a book about how to dunk a basketball. Can we talk?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, most people in their right minds might say, no, I'm sorry. I'm a bit busy. Right. But these people were incredibly generous with their time. Which I think also, by the way, gets at issues of science and communication about, you know, I think scientists quite reasonably can be anxious about whether their ideas will either be misrepresented or reduced to a point that they seem inaccurate.
Sure, because there is a long history of that actually happening. And most right. scientists who have that reticence have it because of a personal experience.
Right, they might have been burned somehow mm-hmm. or other.
Yeah.
So my hat's off to any researchers who are willing to take the time to talk with journalists about things to help them understand and to the scientists and communicators who are listening. One sort of tip I have is mm-hmm. is for the non-scientist communicator like me is to ask the scientist what sort of metaphor or analogy she would use to describe whatever it is that her work is about.
Absolutely. I think that's you hit the nail on the head right there. I've talked to many, many journalists, reporters, and science communicators, both who come from a journalistic background and who come from a science background and then found journalism. Analogy is number one, probably the fastest and most effective way for somebody to understand something complicated. Like, I tried it once. I'm not sure how successful I was when I had to write about the Higgs boson. I was like, how the fuck do you write right. about the Higgs? And I remember working with a physicist. Actually, I was working with Henry Reich, who does Minute Physics on YouTube. And he sat with me, oh my gosh, so sweet, for like 2 hours on Skype. And I was going through, okay, this is my analogy. It's a bomb squad. They're looking for a bomb, but it exploded and they can't find all the parts. And I'm going through and I'd be like, so this is like the bosons. Don't use the word boson. Here you'd want to use fermion. That's a different type of, and you just don't know.
Well, that's why I partly for the sake of expediency, mm-hmm. but partly for the sake of accuracy, I recommend asking the researcher to come up with the metaphor.
Because they probably already have one.
They already have one. And also you then as the reporter can think, okay, he or she scientist gave me this metaphor.
Yeah.
So I'm not screwing this up. Like
totally.
That's like a smart shortcut to doing a lot of science reporting.
Yeah, and also I think that one random tip that I would give is that if the researcher himself or herself is not available, the main person who's like the go-to person, which is always great to be able to talk to, but like you said, a lot of them are like, fuck off, I'm busy. Talk to somebody in their lab. Talk to a graduate student who's dedicating their time to this. They may actually know more because they're in it. They're in the thick of it. And oftentimes I do find that this younger generation of grad students, postdocs, and younger scientists are much more comfortable and open with the idea of science communication, and of they see it almost as a necessity and as part of an obligation to their work.
I think that's definitely right. Yeah.
To open up, and there are, but don't get me wrong, there are a lot of amazing more traditional scientists who
senior
are much older.
Yeah,
senior researchers who do the same thing. But that is something that in the SciComm world we're working on. Some scientists just don't think that sharing with journalists is part of their job. And you're never going to change their minds. But there are plenty. There are a million people out there who will be willing to talk and who will have like just amazing, amazing insights. So
yeah.
That's so cool that you got to meet all of these. I also think that it's something that we should celebrate, a journalist taking time to write a book, because you're never going to be as in depth when you're assigned for a newspaper or magazine. There's varying levels depending on how investigative it is, how much leeway, how much time, how much money you have to be able to follow that lead. But writing a book is something that we should celebrate, because you're taking a little seed and you're really putting, like you said, you took 7 months off of work. You're putting your heart and soul into this, and you get to deep dive and do the type of investigation you'd never be able to do for a general assignment.
Yeah, I mean, the newspaper wouldn't run a 200-page, 85-part series on Asher Price trying to dunk. Exactly. But, I had myself as a subject close at hand. So
yeah.
I was about to sneeze. it's like, artists, often paint these self-portraits. Mm-hmm. And one reason they do that is because they're easy and cheap models, right?
Yeah,
they're fully accessible. And so a lot of the time spent meeting with trainers, working with scientists, but also in a slightly self-involved way, writing about myself, you know.
Sure. And it's the same reason musicians write songs about what happened to them in life. And because also there are these universal themes that I think the only way to tap into them is to listen to yourself. To, you know, we can empathize with others as much as we can, but even sort of the template for empathy is put yourself in those shoes. Try and see what it would feel like if it were happening to you.
Right. And the story, I should say, there's getting at this empathetic thing that you're talking about, there's like a shadow parallel story I tell in this about cancer, because I was a testicular cancer survivor, where I had kind of like, 10 years ago now, I coming on to 10 years,
you
had
been quite young, right? How old were you?
I was 26.
Okay.
Yeah. Had noticed a little lump in my left testicle, and I initially thought, maybe it's showering, and I thought maybe it was just a birthmark that I had never really realized was there. Mm-hmm. And then a couple weeks later, you know, you wake up with an ache in your lower belly, and you think, what is it? Is that thing still there? And then, you know, you go off to the hospital, you get a diagnosis. And so I partly wrote about that because, you know, not everybody is interested in whether some dude can dunk a basketball. But you know, the cancer story is meant to be a kind of foil to that story, a parallel, in the sense that there I also was depending on a set of scientists, doctors, who have testicular cancer is now really among the most curable kinds of cancers you can get, and about how, you know, to what extent now trying to dunk a basketball can I alter my own trajectory with my own working out and my own, you know, jumping exercises, as opposed to this, you know, crack team of doctors that was, helping me, alter my trajectory, 10 years ago as well.
And how much, you know, the process of trying to get past something really major, really medically major in your life, which obviously has so many implications, the medical implications, but also just the psychological implications, the familial, you know, the environmental implications, how much of that really is this strange dance between putting your kind of your mortality in the hands of professionals, but also trying your best to maintain some sense of control over your outcomes. You know, what can I do to help this along?
Right. I mean, to what extent do we weave the fabric of our lives? Mm-hmm. To what extent is that really in our control?
Yeah.
I mean, with the cancer thing, as I said, it's among the most curable. But if you don't get treatment, the outcome isn't good.
Sure, it's among the most curable, which means you have to actually go through the
motions of getting cured.
And that's, it's about, like you said, early detection, about not letting that thing that's nagging you keep nagging you. And then once you're in it, it's about, I think maintaining trust and saying, you know, I'm in many ways putting myself in your hands, but I'm also going to do the things that I know I'm supposed to do. I'm going to show up. I'm going to take the medicine. I'm going to eat better. I'm going to do all those things that you're telling me as part of my treatment.
Yeah, exactly. And I get a little bit into the science of all of that as well, in terms of just, you know, what the chemo cocktail is.
Yeah.
You know, it's with testicular cancer, it's a liquid platinum that they inject into you that
really
the cancer cells don't like.
Interesting. And also none of your other cells like either.
No,
sure.
Right. Yeah. It makes you feel pretty miserable. But I sort of muse about in the book about how I tried to think of myself in some ways like a superhero. That is, you're sort of coursing through your veins is liquid platinum.
Amazing.
And I actually, you know, thought again at that time of Spud Webb, that 5'6" dunker who was his own kind of superhero, I feel like, who defied gravity in some way, right? And here I'm feel like, you know, platinum man, you know, impenetrable and unbreakable or something like that. So there's a kind of you know, as I said, parallel tale that's going on there.
I love that. I think that's a good, you know, a good place here with our conversation where it's really come full circle. And I think just like Spud, you will find that more and more, you probably already have, that more and more you're going to have people reaching out to you and saying like, wow, this is something I went through too, or I'm going through this right now. And you really are something of a role model for me, which I'm sure you never expected.
I just appreciate your having me on to talk about all this stuff.
So much fun. But I can't let you go quite yet, even though you need to get to the airport. So we'll keep this last bit short and sweet, because I end every episode the same way. And like, I'd be remiss if I let you leave without doing it. So at the end of every episode, I ask my guests the same two questions. I have yet to determine what I'm going to do with this. Maybe I'll like montage them out one day. But the questions are this. When you think about the, I'm so excited to hear your perspective too, because I feel like we're always talking about the same themes on the podcast. So this is like totally out of left field. When you think about the future, in whatever context matters to you, whether it's your own personal future, whether it's the future of the planet, humanity, whatever, I want to know first, what is the thing that sort of keeps you up the most at night? What is the thing that you're most concerned about, most worried about? But then on the flip side of that, what are you most optimistic about? What are you excited that the future will hold?
Well, those are
deep.
Those are great deep questions. I
it's
mean,
rough. I'm putting you on the spot here.
Well, I mean, I think so. You know, on a personal level, certain anxieties about mortality keep me up at night.
Sure.
But on a global level, I mean, especially being in Texas, you know, there are pronounced issues, and now here in California, of mm-hmm. course, about water. Mm-hmm. You know, there are a lot of people moving to Texas, and people are using water more efficiently than they used to. But it's going to be a dire problem. Maybe, I mean, in some ways, we're seeing it already in our lifetimes, obviously. But I think long after we're gone, it's going to be. It's going to be a dicey situation. So I'd say, and that's something I write about a lot, is the politics and issues involving water. And mm-hmm. and that's something that has to get settled out. I'd say the thing that I'm most optimistic about, I mean, I think at least there are smart people thinking about these issues. And going back to water, for example, we've shown our ability that if we're willing to sacrifice or change our behavior, we can be more efficient.
Yeah.
Which actually can be cheaper for everybody. I mean, you know, lower bills and so on. So, mm-hmm. Dick Fosbury was able to change the way he jumped over a high bar. You know, we can change the way that we use water and energy.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And we're, like you said, we're already seeing it. We're seeing more kind of toilet to tap. We're seeing more really innovative ways that we can capture all of the sort of runoff that we create anyway. Oh, yeah. And just reuse it.
There's a lot more to be done. I'm
yeah,
sure.
Yeah. There's no reason to think, just like with solar and electric vehicles and like that, we're starting to see these closed loops. There's no reason to think that when it comes to water consumption, that this can't be, you know, something of a leaky but relatively closed loop. And I'm actually very excited for the future of that as well. As you said, living here in LA, it's something that we do look forward to and we have to be really mindful of. Well, Asher, before you go, why don't you, one more time, let everybody know the name of the book, where they can find it, and also how they can kind of be in touch, you know, if they're interested in some of the articles that you've written for the Austin American Statesman, or even following up on the book, so like Twitter, Facebook, whatever you're involved with.
Sure. Okay. Yeah. The book is called Year of the Dunk, A Modest Defiance of Gravity, and you can get it at your local bookstore. You can get it online. At the usual places, and you, if you want to email me about anything, you can email me at ashergbprice@hotmail.com. I'm a reporter at the Austin American Statesman, and statesman.com has all, you know, has my news stories covering energy and the environment, And it's just a pleasure to be on a show like this with, you know, someone who thinks so thoughtfully about science and communication. And thanks a lot.
Oh, thank you. So much fun to have you. And I love how open journalists are with like contact information. I always think it's so great. They're right, like, shoot me an email.
There's the Twitter thing too, right? Like at Asher Price and all that kind
you
of thing.
Are there.
People
okay,
can
great.
People can get in touch with me however they like.
For sure. Okay. That's absolutely amazing, guys. Reach out to him. You said at Asher Price.
That's right.
Say hi. Tell him how much you like the episode and that you're going to go buy his book.
Thanks, guys.
Go buy his book. Okay, well, it was so much fun. Thank you again for being on. And thank you everybody who tuned in this week and who tunes in week after week. You guys are amazing. And I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.